some point philosophically along the line, we replaced the purest pleasure, right, which we can call virtue, is sort of the maximization of pure pleasures, with just maximum pleasure, hedonism. And then when we sort of fattened ourselves out on hedonism, no pun intended, you know, but I do mean metaphorically there. When we fattened ourselves out on it, we became
nihilism.
Yeah, we decided that there was nothing after it. There was nothing to pursue. And so we just, now we don't even, now it's exactly as you said, COVID happens. And then we're so, I don't even want to say decadent. I think we're worse than that. I think we don't even care. Like, we've actually reached the point where we no longer care. We're just like, I can't be bothered.
You're listening to the Wake Up Podcast with Alex Fetsky, the place where the most dynamic thinkers and practitioners in the world drop truth bombs and contrarian viewpoints to help you become the best version of yourself. Find us on the Fountain app and send us a boost with a comment.
We're back for part two of the Malka series. If you've not yet heard part one, that was the episode just before this one, and if you want to hear the original genesis story of Rob Malka, which was one of the most listened to episodes of the Wake Up Podcast to date, it is number 62. I promise your mind will be blown. In this part two of the series, we explore Nietzsche, Rousseau, symbolism, the Gothic era, architecture, aesthetics, handball being a game for prisoners, the Dark Ages, vitality and quality, and a whole lot more. We even close out with 4 minutes of Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto as a musical representation of what's happening in the world today. This is a fascinating discussion and one which we shall continue in subsequent series where we get more into the philosophy. We didn't really get into it this time. So hope you enjoy the show. Follow Rob's work at malkarobert.com, and remember to subscribe to the Wake Up Podcast for more.
90s was kind of like the last era of innocence in the US. There was still this, like, you know, drive for innocent innovation. Like, it was pre-internet to a large degree. I remember the fashion was the worst, right? You know, you had like, 90s was probably like the worst decade for fashion in history, but it was kind of like, for example, I watched Blow with Johnny Depp the other week, and I mean that was 70s, right? Like, where he moves from, I think he was in Massachusetts or whatever, and then he moves to California, and, like, you know, you had the California beach, and, you know, every girl was a stewardess, and they're all out there, you know, smoking weed. It was like that. It was such an open, innocent, you know, it was a very different culture. And then you know, the 80s had its own thing, like, you know, rock and roll, and I don't know, I still give the 90s some credit, because it, you know, maybe it was just an echo of the past, but it was the last point, like, post 2000 America, kind of like something changed in the soul of America that made it much more of a police state. So yeah, I need to elaborate on that a little bit further.
There's a story, I can't remember who did it. I think it might have been like an Egyptian prime minister. I can't remember who it was, but he was an Arab, and he came to the United States in like the late 40s, early 50s after World War II. And the thing he said after he looked around was, "We need to burn this down immediately." You know? And so
when was this?
This was the late 40s, early 50s.
Okay.
Yeah. There's something about his immediate reaction. I spent a lot of time in the Middle East, right? And so I understand that very well. Like, it's very, it has a kind of immediacy to me, this, like, just this Arab guy looking around at people, you know, eating in and out and partying with music. And he's like, yeah, this has got to go, man. We got to get rid of this. But I think there's something to his point, right? Which is to say that there was a nihilism even then that we didn't notice, because we still had fun going to bars and partying, you know, like, mm-hmm, we were still interested in getting girls, but it's not a, there wasn't a higher ideal. Like, can we name one from the 40s onward? Can we name one from the early 20s onward?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of one, like a genuine higher goal to sort of mobilize around. There was a Great Depression. People spent their, you know, kids spent their time hopping on trains around the country, you know, like literally freight train, like they would just hop into the cargo side, like sneak in and sleep in whatever was there, and hop off when they could just to see the country. But like that gives me also a sense of this kind of aimlessness. And it doesn't seem to me to be very different from what we have now, except that our aimlessness has been sort of relegated to the online world, which is worse because that's all mind and no body, as it were. I don't like separating them, but in this case, the internet is very much a kind of like all brain, no body. But it's, yeah, there's still that fundamental, like, I don't know what the hell we're doing here. So I think Bitcoin is maybe the first time I've felt that there's a chance for us to come up with something new as the result of, you know, as a result of breaking the system apart a little bit, or opening up a crack in it further, right? That's sort of my answer to that is, okay, yeah, that's why I feel like that. Like, I remember the 90s, you know, very romantically, nostalgically as well, but I would bet that if we asked, you know, most people about their childhoods, or that, you know, the decade they were in, whether it was the, you know, the insanity of the 50s or the 60s, you know, whatever it might be, that they still remember something fondly about it.
Mm.
I just don't know if it's because we were born in that decade that our first 10 years are always like, oh, this is all so nice. And I mean, LA wasn't as grimy then as it is now, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder what triggered this for me. I think I was talking to someone about, like, you know, comedy was one thing. Like, you know, you had Seinfeld and the stuff you could say in the 90s, like now there's no way you could say any of that stuff, right? So it's kind of like, you know, society has become so extraordinarily, like, fragile and delicate that, like, you know, the 90s was the last time that could happen. Like, you know, and you had movies like, I mean, I movies is a big litmus test for me, like, you know, kind of like architecture is for you, but like movies, you had Braveheart, you had, you know, the Matrix, you had these kind of ambitious attempts at portraying a story, which just doesn't exist anymore. Like, I cannot for the fucking life of me find a decent movie today. Like, I have to go back to the night. Like, you had, you know, for example, I don't know if you ever watched Legends of the Fall, like with Brad Pitt, and oh my god, fucking incredibly powerful movie. Like, it's set in kind of I think it's the early 1900s, so kind of like when the bootlegging of liquor was kind of going on. So it was a prohibition. So it is an extraordinarily powerful movie, and it follows like three brothers through World War One. You know, and the youngest brother dies, etc. But I don't want to give away too much of it. But, you know, I encourage everyone to go watch that movie. But those kinds of you know, I remember like Brad Pitt and Harrison Ford in The Devil's Own. I don't know if you remember that one. Like, he's the Irish kid who comes to America and all this stuff. So it's like it was kind of like the last echo of like trying to do stuff that was less showmanship. Like, because now, like, the big moonshots feel very like glittery and very showmanship to me. It's like, you know, I'm gonna build a fucking rocket and we're gonna go live in Mars. It's like, really? I don't know, man. Like, it doesn't sit right with me. Like, so you had kind of, you know, the movies, the, you know, there was some innocence, you know, comedy was different, and yes, there was aimlessness, nihilism and stuff like that. I can't discount that. I think that's been probably I think that's a problem of affluence everywhere, though. I don't think that's uniquely American. I think that is, you know, because me having grown up in Australia, you know, there's a purposelessness there as well, because everyone's just fundamentally had it so good. I think struggle is what creates meaning to a large degree. And most people that I've ever met that, you know, that place a larger value on meaning are people who've had to deal with struggle. So anyway, I don't know exactly what triggered that thought, because I remember I just wrote it down as a comment somewhere. I was like, you know, the 2000s changed, like 1999 was the last year of innocence for the US. Like even things like, you know, entering and exiting like the border, like it wasn't that bad. Like after 2001, something happened, right? I mean, obviously two fucking planes crashed into a thing, right? You know, but other than that, like, like something happened. Like now you need to fucking take your shoes off and like spread your asshole so they can ram a fucking thing up. You know, like you got to stand in these, you know, X-ray things and like get scanned. It's like none of that was there in the 90s. You know, there were still hot stewardesses, for example, you know, on a plane, like, and it was still kind of cool to get a job as a stewardess. Now it's like fat old bitches and gay guys. It's like, and I mean, you know, congratulations, they've got a job, but it's not pleasant. I'd much rather be served by a hot chick on a plane. So I don't know, like, Maybe it wasn't the peak, but it was like the last echo of like the innocence of America.
I'm just waiting to hear from a Bitcoiner that they've set up Hooters Airlines, and yeah,
dude, it's coming. I'm telling you, that's one project I'll be involved in for fucking sure.
For sure, yeah, on the board. I guess this is the biggest thing I want to say, Just about every great thing in human history has been done by wealthy people, by affluent people. That is to say, the Greek Wars, Alcibiades was wealthy, Nicias was wealthy, right? We're talking about the Peloponnesian War here. You know, the Battle of Marathon. Alexander was a wealthy Greek, Macedonian who conquered the Greeks and then moved all the way to Persia. And I guess I slipped the Greek thing because I think Alexander the Great actually is the best Greek, even though he wasn't Greek. He best manifested the qualities of being Greek. So many of these things were done by people who were already established, and then they saw money as superfluous. They saw it as like a necessary but not nearly sufficient thing, right? We had mannerism. We had outlook, we had art, we had our, we had things that cohered into something that you could not fake, right? It was sort of, it was very similar to the proof of work mechanism, but culturally, right? Mm-hmm. You couldn't imitate being an aristocrat. So one example is in George Eliot's Middlemarch, this little detail really rang out to me. If you haven't read that book, amazing book, please read it. George Eliot's real name is Mary Evans, and she wrote an outstanding work on provincial life in England, and really insightful. She's very didactic, which I think rubbed some people the wrong way, but anyway, awesome. So considered one of the great best novels in the English language, maybe the best. And one of the characters, Dorothy, is in love with this older man, this much, much older man who's an intellectual. I mean, she's a very kind of spiritual woman, and she's very interested in this guy who's pursuing this really dumb, I mean, frankly, you know, just this very stupid equivalent of a lifetime doctoral thesis that is about, you know, some little thing that no one is ever going to read, right? Just like some little cobweb book that he's never able to finish. And she wants to support him in that quest, and so she wants to marry him. You know, no matter how long it takes, she wants to see him finish this book. And her sister makes this remark about his character that she wasn't at all impressed by him, but the remark was around the way he ate his soup. He scraped his bowl with the spoon. So like as he picked up the sort of the soup, the broth, it would scrape the bottom. And I was thinking to myself, like, wait, how do you eat soup without doing that? Like I was actually confused. So I've tried it. I've tried to do it. I'm telling you, it's not possible. I don't know how they do it. It's unbelievable. Try it. Seriously, try like having soup without scraping the bottom of the bowl. Anyway, you're a vulgar non-class act if you do that in like provincial England, right? We're talking about provincial England. We're talking about, you know, moderately wealthy families, but They knew class when they saw it, and it was in little things like that. You would never be able to fake something like that. That was that's a lifetime of practice, is eating soup that particular way. So, so that's what we've missed, right? That's what I mean when I'm talking about sort of nihilism, aimlessness, is it was just some point philosophically along the line, we replaced the purest pleasure, right? Which we can call virtue, is sort of the maximization of pure pleasures, with just maximum pleasure, hedonism. And then when we sort of fattened ourselves out on hedonism, no pun intended, you know, but I do mean metaphorically there. When we fattened ourselves out on it, we became
nihilism.
Yes, we decided that there was nothing after it. There was nothing to pursue. Mm. And so we just, now we don't even, now it's exactly as you said, COVID happens. And then we're so, I don't even want to say decadent. I think we're worse than that. I think we don't even care. Like, we've actually reached the point where we no longer care. We're just like, I can't be bothered. Like, I don't care. And that's way, by the way, I just have to say, that's way worse than I don't know, people burning themselves in protest, or people all attacking a legislature, like just not caring anymore, or just being too lazy, or just everybody's like, I'm, you know, too tired to be hysterical. That's pretty bad. Like, culturally, we're in very bad shape. So, you know, we went from a sister who would advise her sister against marrying a guy because he can't hold a spoon right, he can't eat soup right. I mean, think about the level of detail, distinction, you know, attention, vitality you would need just to discriminate a marriageable individual on that basis, right? Mm-hmm. Versus they shut down your entire economy, they starve tons of people, you know, like every difficult thing imaginable, and everybody's like, it wasn't that bad. I don't remember it as that bad anyway. I was watching a lot of Netflix.
Yeah. Yeah. Fuck. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, I don't mean to be a Debbie Downer, but I think, you know, we have a lot of work to do. And I think so much of it does actually come down to architecture. I am really obsessed with it. Our cities are unlivable. They're built for cars, not for people.
Yes.
Everywhere you look is basically a box slum, you know, like everything is a grid format. The homes are not built in any special way. They're all identical. Nobody built those homes with their own hand. Nobody actually, everyone had to hire some sort of interior designer, which I think is actually a socialist told me this once, but I think he's right, that sort of, if you need an interior designer, it's suggestive of a mental illness. Like, there's just something not right about that. Like, tell me how I want my place to look where I'm going to live every day of your life. And you're there's just something wrong with that. Right. So, don't do that. Don't get an interior designer. You know,
this is why I do this podcast. Last week. Interior design disrespectives. Let's start a new, like,
yeah, Twitter right movement. Yeah. Right. The IDDs. Like IEDs, but less explosive, but more explosive.
Maybe more explosive.
Yeah, more explosive. So, I don't remember where I was going. I think that says it. That says it. Like, architecture matters. Making cities where people can congregate, having a unique style that shows the personality of the people there, raising kids in a place where they are able to imagine something bigger than themselves. Right. If you spend every day walking by a Gothic church, right? Something very large and imposing. And it's supposed to represent, you know, the grandness of God. I mean, I think there's it's very hard to grow up around that and not feel pulled toward the heavens, right? Mm. And there are all kinds of ways to reconceive of our world that don't have to be toward the sky, right? You don't have to see things in that way. But that's a thing, right? These are, you know, how can you feel complete and whole in your soul if you're spending most of your time on asphalt, right? Which is where most of us spent our school days. There were very little trees. There was a lot of asphalt, where the ground is a danger to you, I mean, that just seems very strange. If I fall and I hit my head, I get brain damage on asphalt. If I scrape myself, I mean, it's very easy to scrape yourself. Whereas, like, whatever, you fall on grass, it's nothing. So, you know, it's not possible to play on asphalt, really. I mean, we played like handball, but what was handball? It was a game for prisoners. And then, frankly, you like hit a ball against a wall and please, I mean, please.
I mean, it permeates everything, like schooling and everything is all, everything's in a fucking box, basically.
That's it. That's it. Everything is a box. And that's because it's easy to build, right? For the same reason that big pharma won't do tests that cost hundreds of millions of dollars on things that cost 10 cents to make.
Yeah.
Similarly, we're not going to reconceive of architecture. We're not going to go through those projects if it turns out they're very elaborate and very expensive to do. And that's partly a factor of inflation. And that's also partly because we have delegated literally every aspect of our lives to somebody else, but to someone else's who have no vested interest in the world that we live in. I think just to go full circle, you know, when you talk about being local and emphasizing locality, right? That also says something like, hey, you shouldn't be allowed to build here if you don't live here. I mean, somebody is going to sit there, you know, some mayor is going to sit there in his town, and he's going to look around and he's going to make that realization, and he's going to pass that law, or he's going to urge the passing of that law. And then people will, you know, scream about it. Home prices will go up. This will go up, whatever. And he'll say something like, no, man, like we can get supplies from anywhere. We have a global supply chain, you know, or whatever, a national supply chain, whatever you want to say. That's fine. But we cannot have the cultural capital built outside of this town. Cultural capital must be local. And if our cultural capital sucks, then it sucks, right? We may have to find another way to go about this. But we can't, you know, I don't know how much longer we can do this kind of madness for. I mean, it's gotten to the point where we have a metaverse. Like, who's that built by? Like, what are we doing?
Yeah, like completely externally architected by someone else. Yeah, yeah. So actually, I love that you tied it back into the original conversation around localism, because I think all of this is downstream from, like you said, there's no vested interest in the local vicinity anymore. So it's, you know, the federal government or a globalist government is about as far detached as you can get from anything meaningful locally. And by its very nature, it has to be, because it can't be everywhere at all times. So it needs to pass these, you know, hand wavy, like, you know, blanket mandates, which have no relationship or no semblance to anything on the ground. So it seems completely fucking seems mindless in that sense. So I wanted to, yes. Yeah, so anyway, I think what we said earlier about the reemergence of culture in a local sense, I think hopefully will move us back towards aesthetics. You were about to say something?
Yeah, just quickly, which is, I mean, I'm going to get a lot of flack for this, but it's true that whatever faults you see in colonialism basically never displaced local cultures in lieu of a national culture or a supranational culture. So globalism, in a sense, is actually worse. Globalism has deprived everybody of their regional cuisines in place of McDonald's. I mean, that's a very serious, I don't think, you know, I think we've gotten so used to it. Like, we're so blasé about it. Like, yeah, there's a McDonald's everywhere, but we're also Americans, and we feel very comfortable being, you know, seeing a McDonald's everywhere. It makes us feel at home, something like that. But, you know, if you're in Indonesia, like, heads up, you're not at home, you know, like, that's not where you are. So, like, you know, like, other cultures don't just exist for your curiosity. They exist because like they mean to be there. They have some deeper thing that they're pursuing. So globalism threatens to uproot quite literally all of that, in place of just some kind of factory farming thing. I mean, you know, I don't know anyone who really deeply likes globalism. I'm very surprised by, I would be very surprised, I suppose, by people who do.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there is a few who do. But anyway, I wanted to ask you on the topic of like architecture and aesthetics and stuff like that. One thing we shot back and forth on Telegram before we booked this in was this idea of the Dark Ages and how much of a myth or non-myth that is. And I mean, I've always questioned the existence of a supposed Dark Ages, as if like everything went to shit. And I wonder how much of that is true and how much of that is bullshit. And I haven't done enough reading on it. I would love to, and it's an area that I'm really interested in. So I'm curious to hear your feedback.
Yeah, I mean, my handling on the Dark Ages is pretty limited. But I guess I can speak in very vague terms. I mean, I'll say for sure in one sentence that you can't claim that somebody who built all the churches that were built and somebody who organized European cities the way that they did were dumb. Mm-hmm. It just seems outrageous to me. Like you can't say that all, like, again, going back to architecture, like if you look at the architecture of the time, many, many extraordinarily beautiful churches were built. That suggests a kind of vitality and life that was going on in those times. And they did that. They did these kinds of they achieved that kind of architecture. I don't know why I'm so emphatic about it today, but I guess I'm just feeling it. But they achieved it sort of taking at least a third of the year off. Like they spent so much time in festivals. They didn't work the way that we do in with only like 2 weeks off a year. Yeah, I mean it's not really an area of expertise, but I know that there are a ton of political events that are considered, you know, during the Dark Ages, the Crusades being one example, when there was actually a lot of, you know, it was a very vital time going to different places, going to war, for the sake of Christianity. My suspicion has been always that, and again, I'll have to look into this a bit more, but my suspicion has always been that the Dark Ages has been called that way because they were such Christian times.
Interesting.
It's a kind of way to minimize sort of any Christian victories. I believe Thomas Aquinas was writing during the proverbial Dark Ages. I'll have to double check that. But, you know, Thomas Aquinas is a pretty amazing thinker. That I think that kind of sums up all I'm really able to say about it. We'll have to find a legitimate expert on the 1000s and so on.
See. So what is the period that they suggest is the Dark Ages? Is it the sort of the 1000s or is it the pre-1000s?
Yeah, that's a good question. I will find out. Let me see. We're going to look it up together. So early Middle Ages. So I guess it was, the 1330s. That's about it. 1330s.
Sounds overly specific.
Concept, started in the 1330s. But I guess it's, what are they saying? So. Yeah, they say they avoid the term altogether. And then supposedly it's from the 5th to the 10th centuries. That's like, mm-hmm. If you were to name it, that would be that era. But I just, it's, as I said, I don't really buy into it. And then apparently most people don't buy into it anymore. It's not really a thing.
Yeah, I don't know. To me, it feels like one of those things that's a given. It's like, we went through the dark ages where we lost X centuries worth of progress. I was talking about this specific thing with someone. Now I can't even remember who it was. Actually, with Mark Moss, he always uses it as an example. And I was like, you know what? I don't think all that dark ages shit is true. I think it's kind of like a dark washing of history to paint a particular picture of how we behaved before a particular change. So anyway, I'm gonna do some more digging on that myself to understand a little bit better. Anything else to add to this little chapter of architecture, aesthetics, symbolism, before we move on to something else?
Nothing off the top of my head. Can jump on to the next thing.
Yeah, okay. So looking at the thing you sent me, got some stuff around like the three waves of modernity. Speak of nothing but trade and money as something that Rousseau said. Can we pull on that thread a little bit? Curious to hear your feedback and thoughts on that.
Yeah, this is a big one. So, so basically, you're referring to this big complaint that that Rousseau had, and so like I guess, let me give some basic
context.
Facts. Yeah. So, Rousseau is considered the proto-communist of our time. He's the philosophical proto-communist. I don't think that's necessarily unfair, but Rousseau is also much more than that. Like he's a really outstanding thinker and he's a really outstanding philosopher. And we should always be taking him seriously. He seduced a lot of very compelling minds to some very interesting ideas. And so I wouldn't be hard on him. I think he's just one of those figures. But he was a critic of modernity even then, this late 1700s or so. And he said mid to late 1700s. And he said something like, "The ancient politicians spoke unceasingly of manners and virtue, and ours speak of nothing but trade and money." So he saw that as a problem even then, right? So we were already on a kind of societal decline way back at that time. So and like that spoon example, right, that I mentioned earlier comes from a time and a place where he already thought that we were losing that. So to really understand that comment, like we kind of have to go all the way back. The thing that we're talking about or referring to is Leo Strauss wrote an essay called The Three Waves of Modernity, and they can basically be summed up as Machiavelli, Rousseau, and Nietzsche. And we're in the middle of this third wave. And so I guess I should say a little bit about Leo Strauss. Basically, the way I like to sum him up is that he basically took the way Jews have traditionally read Talmud and he applied it to all the other works in the Western tradition. But it's much more, he's much more complicated than that. And I think he has this kind of exhilarating take on so many works because he sees them in terms of political philosophy. Like he has a really deep understanding of politics and he sees that as being one of the best ways to actually observe like to grapple with a text. So he helps reframe all of modern, you know, all of modernism in terms of these three figures. And I think he's very right. I think he's on the money. There are a lot of great books by Leo Strauss, if you want to read any. One is, I would recommend, is On Tyranny. Please read that. He basically takes Xenophon. It's called the, I never say it right, but the Hiero, H-I-E-R-O. I'm going to verify that. Let me see. Hang on. I want to make sure that I have that.
What was the name of his book again? What was it? On Tyranny, yeah?
On Tyranny, yeah. So basically, it's this little dialogue called the H-I-E-R-O, the Hiero, or the Hieron, which would be, that's how you would say it, or Hieron is how you would say it in the ancient Greek. And it's basically whether a tyrant's life is more pleasant than a commoner's, right? So like, is it better to be a tyrant or is it not? And the dialogue itself, like if you read On Tyranny, he has the dialogue at the beginning and it seems very uninteresting. Like you're not really into it. And then what he does is he unfolds the entire dialogue, right? And it's actually breathtaking. You see why why people are so in love with him. There are some people who think Strauss is an unimportant thinker. Maybe he didn't consider himself, in all modesty, he was a very modest man. He didn't consider himself a real philosopher. And I think actually that's right. I think he just explicated very well what other philosophers believed. He did a wonderful job in doing so. But he did it in this very particular way that's now called, to be a Straussian, or Strauss, you know, like Straussianism, as it were. So what do I want to say about the three waves of modernity? So he says something like, we're in a crisis today, and that crisis is that we actually no longer believe we can know what's good or bad and right and wrong. And you know, you see that all the time in people who are like, oh, well, relativism, anything can be right. Some people believe this, some people believe that. And the saddest thing about the day we live in today is that we actually believe that's a form of progress, like not believing in anything. We can be anything, mm-hmm. identify as anything, just do whatever we want. Like that's supposedly progress. That's freedom. But that's really not what it is, right? I don't really think freedom is deciding to be a furry one day and something else the next day. You know, it just doesn't strike me as being helpful, as being a Latin American one day and then an African another day or whatever. And that's where we're going, right? This sort of idea of being transracial or transabled or whatever it might be. This is actually really indicative of, yeah, well, there are people, this really gets to me because, you know, deaf parents and all, but there are people who disable themselves so that they can be called disabled. I don't know what to make of those people. It's a very strange thing. And I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it. It makes me too upset. So that is, that's a thing. And, you know, we need things to be easy, but we would have cause and effect inverted if we believed that because we want things to be easy, we have this sort of lack of belief that we can know what's good or bad or right or wrong. We have this problem ultimately about not knowing what's good or bad, right and wrong. We have this this other issue because of I'm sorry, we have these kind of like transability figures or this general broad movement in identity, politics or the problem of identity, because our biology has already declined, because we slowly, gradually over time stopped believing in, this is a Nietzsche thing, right? We stopped believing in God with any depth, with any sincerity. And that was in part a kind of biological phenomenon. We just became more decadent over time. We got weaker over time. So the oversimplified way is to talk about prosperity. You know, we had this sort of obsession with prosperity, which we'll talk about with Rousseau, but at the expense of at the expense of our kind of our personal goal, purpose, a broad purpose, right? To make a play, make heaven on earth, or to do God's will on earth, rather. So when we said we wanted heaven on earth instead of doing God's will on earth, we actually kind of it was indicative of the fact that we were no longer who we used to be. I don't know if that makes, does that make any sense? Does that make sense?
Say that last part again. So
yeah, So we know we you know what? Let me just read. Give me 1 second. Hang on. Okay, so there's this section in Twilight of the Idols by Nietzsche that talks about the four great errors. It's pretty mind-blowing. And I'm just going to read from paragraph 2 or section 2 of the four great errors. He says this: the most general formula that lies at the basis of every religion and morality is do such and such, don't do such and such. That will make you happy, or else. Every morality, every religion is this imperative. I call it the great original sin of reason, the immortal unreason. So I'm going to stop there just for a second. So basically he's saying something like, there was a time, or he talks about this separately. There was a time when we really believed that doing such and such and not doing such and such would make us happy, right? That was a profound belief. We were really committed to that. And we did so for hundreds or thousands of years. And then slowly with the rise of the age of reason, and the belief that reason took power over all, we started to emphasize reason over belief. And then our beliefs started to degrade more and more. Our faith in things started to degrade more and more, but then nothing took its place because gradually we saw that we were not reasonable beings. We're actually not rational beings at all. So prioritized reason, we weakened our belief in God, and then we replaced it with nothing. So that ended up creating, I mean, this is, you know, really like in a sentence, that ended up creating this kind of nihilism. Like, what do you put in place? So we don't have reason, we just have the passions, but then all we have are the passions. Now what? We just have feelings? I'm angry, I'm sad, I'm happy. Well, on the basis of what? I don't know, I'm just sad. Like, what are we going to apply them to? I don't know, I'm just sad. I don't feel any, you know. So we gradually became a people who destroyed our institutions, right? So he keeps going. Do you want me to stop there?
Please. No, go.
Okay, yeah. So he says, in my mouth, this formula changes into its opposite. First example of my revaluation of all values. Well-constituted people, happy ones, happy's in quotes there, have to do certain acts and instinctively shrink away from other acts. They import the orderliness, which is evident in their physiology, into their relations to people and things. In a formula, their virtue is the effect of their happiness. Long life and many offspring are not the reward of virtue. Instead, virtue itself is the slow metabolism that, among other things, also has a long life, many offspring, and in short, cornerism as its consequence. Cornerism is something from the previous paragraph, from the previous section, which I'll read right after. The Church and morality say a race, a people is destroyed by vice and luxury. My reconstituted reason says when a people is perishing, physiologically degenerating, the effects of this are vice and luxury. That is the need for stronger and stronger, more and more frequent stimuli, the kind of stimuli that are familiar to every exhausted nature. This young man gets prematurely pale and flabby. His friends say this is due to such and such a sickness. I say the fact that he got sick, that he did not resist the sickness, was already the effect of an impoverished life, an inherited exhaustion. The newspaper reader says this party is destroying itself by making such a mistake. My higher politics says a party that makes such mistakes is over. It no longer has sure instincts. Every mistake, this is amazing, in every sense is the effect of degenerate instincts, of a disintegrated will. This virtually defines the bad. Everything good is instinct and consequently is easy, necessary, free. Exertion is an objection. The god is typically different from the hero. In my language, light feet are the first attribute of godliness. So I don't know. I find that fucking mind blowing. I'd love your thoughts on it.
I mean, I remember you sent me this actually, I think about a month ago, and I had a read of that. So the takeaway, at least from what I can interpret, is what we see as the effects of things are not actually the cause. It's the opposite way around. Like, because we've given up, or because we've lost will, or because we've as he describes, they're like, you got sick because you didn't resist the sickness. It's kind of like turns the concept on its head. The symptom is not the cause, basically, in that sense. Like, and I think he makes the case for that. So please pull on that further.
Yeah. So he goes so far as to say that that somewhere along the line, our biology began to disintegrate. Mm-hmm. So he has a whole story about that. I think it'd be too long to get into here, but I'll just say it that way, that our physiology became weak and decadent. And that is normal for most times and places. So the Greeks were once this very high, they were this sort of physiologically peak condition. And then, as he discusses in Twilight of the Idols, Socrates came along and he was proof that they were already starting to lose their instinct, already lose their footing. So we've long since become a people who has no sure instinct. We doubt every step of the way, we struggle, mm-hmm. right? And I think Nietzsche would say, he's an optimist, even though he's making these observations, he would say something like, have, to the extent you can, have mastery over your drives and fall fully into your instinct. It's better that you fully become your instinct rather than try to be anything other than you are. Like, there's mm-hmm. nothing left to do. And his hope is that the people who do that properly, who learn not to question themselves and who fully go with their instinct, become that somebody so great that they can't be stopped from transforming society again or from doing something incredible sort of comes out of that, like rises out of that.
So talk actually, let's just pull on this physiological degradation or disintegration piece. Like, what do you mean? Do you mean like a losing touch with our instincts, or do you mean that like an actual physical, like we're getting fat, flabby, and sloppy?
I think they're both true. I think they're both right. Okay. Yeah. So this is what I want to say. Have you ever met somebody who, it doesn't really matter what happens to them. They just kind of emerge almost happier. Like, they go through shit and then it doesn't seem like there's any trauma to speak of. It's all like water off a duck's back. I'm not sure how it happens, but they go to the gym, they lift, they do great. They, their body comes naturally. Their work comes naturally. They work whatever, 2-3 jobs, but they still have this kind of energy about them. Those people are very rare, but I think you can, you find them. Mm-hmm. And you would say those are people who are well constituted. Mm-hmm. And then there are people who are highly privileged. They have everything. And then they, shave their heads and scream all day as a sophomore in college, not that there's anything wrong with, I guess, shaving your head and screaming. So the those people are not well constituted. So I guess there is something wrong with shaving your head and screaming all day as a sophomore in college. But that's the idea, right? Those people can't be fixed. They are part of I think Nietzsche would go so far as to say that they're part of a biological caste of people. Mm-hmm. But these are actually two fundamentally different classes of people, and that we're getting into really dangerous territory when we talk about this, actually.
Yeah.
But I think, I guess I'll just leave it there, because it's, I think, any look at the demographics of the modern day would say that, this is not, it's not so much a race issue as it is an issue of physiology explicitly. what you become is indicative of what you are.
Mm-hmm. So here's a question. What do you say about someone like a Mike Tyson in his peak?
Yeah, I mean, what a fascinating figure. My guess, I mean, it's hard because I don't know the guy personally. I mean, his fighting instinct is incredible, right? I mean, he's not only incredibly talented, but I think all told, you know, just given what he went through, he managed his life, you know, well. I'm really not sure. I'm really not sure. It'd be very hard to say.
What do you mean? What's hard to say specifically?
It's hard to see whether he was somebody whoever really had the kind of shaking self-doubt that would paralyze him. Fights never seem to be hard for him. So as far as, yeah, I mean, I think everybody looks at him and goes, you know, he's godlike in his ability to take another guy down. His personal life obviously was bumpier. Yeah, Russian to the bone. I don't know. There's just something I really love about Russian conductors, Russian composers. Yeah.
More than the Viennese?
Oh, I mean, you're picking like the two greatest groups, you know? I can't compare the two. I love them both. I love them both. Beethoven, I would say like Beethoven's Ninth is probably the greatest piece of music to ever come out of humanity, period. And he only heard it in his head. It's a pretty amazing thing.
Yeah, wild. That's one thing I think that I really, you know, respect and admire about you is, you know, you're one of the few people I've met who's got such a grasp on, I guess for lack of a better term, like these classical cultural ideas and concepts, like, you know, whether it's architecture, music, or philosophy, like, and it's almost like you're born in the wrong fucking era.
Yeah, I mean, I would say this about myself, that I have a body of knowledge that I think used to be taken for granted about 150, 200 years ago in certain social circles. Mm-hmm. And they were probably your average member of an aristocracy was probably better at, had probably memorized far more Shakespeare than I have, and could probably speak much, much more about somebody like Rachmaninoff. I mean, 200 years ago, there wasn't any, right? But could probably say more about, say, Beethoven and the Ninth than I can. And it's just that we've been dumbed down more and more. So I was watching Much Ado About Nothing, which is an amazing play by Shakespeare. If you have the chance to watch the film with Kenneth Branagh, please do. It's basically like a rom-com. It's Shakespeare's version of a rom-com, you know? And I think he did, I actually would say, I think he did come up with the rom-com. Like, it's such a wonderful play. But I think it would take a lot of effort for people to watch today, and that's a shame, you know. Like we've replaced this thing where you can listen, you can watch it in a shallow way and still enjoy it, and you can watch it in a deep way and really enjoy it. Mm. Like that flexibility of option has kind of disappeared from our cultural palette. So now it's all shallow. So now if you're a deep guy looking for deep things, you're gonna struggle to find a place in the culture where you can relate, right? That's actually what's happened. So we went towards mediocrity, and then all that ended up happening is people who want to go for something great have trouble connecting with one another, mm-hmm. or things mm-hmm. that are meaningful. So it used to be that if I wanted to flirt with a girl and she wasn't nearly as interested in deep stuff as I was, we could still talk about the same things. Like, people forget about this, right? So if we both watch Much Ado About Nothing and she loves Much Ado About Nothing and I love it for a different reason than she does, we can still cover it. Like, we can still do something interesting with that content. But now it's, if I have trouble, like if I don't know TikTok because I don't want to know TikTok culture, I have no way to relate to somebody who does watch it, right? Whether you're a, like, I don't know. It doesn't really matter where you come from. Like, I guess a couple boomers do TikTok, you know, who knows, but, so it's, you know, there are always exceptions to that rule, but it's also that we don't have a cultural basis for content anymore. Like, we've become so atomized and so spread out. So quote unquote individual, which is, you know, pretty much a nonsense word. Like, it's not, I wouldn't even say it's necessarily a good word, but we've become so obsessed with that, that somebody can actually, two people within the same city or the same neighborhood can have totally different cultural foundations, never, ever having watched the same piece of content ever. I think that's insane, right? Mm-hmm. Never having engaged with the same piece of content. So I could really be into Black Mirror and The Northman, and somebody else could be really into The Handmaid's Tale. And I don't know. I don't know what else. I don't really watch much. But that basically means that they and I have no way to really circle around certain ideas, to have certain conversations. I mean, what you consume, what you grapple with matters. And then the other thing is that I'm not going to reenact Black Mirror, but Shakespeare was such that you could, you know, he was like Bitcoin in that he was inclusive. His education was inclusive. You could be Shakespeare anytime. It was set up so that anybody could play the roles of any of his characters. If you really liked the tragedy of Macbeth, you know, you could run towards Macbeth. If you really liked Hamlet, you could go towards Hamlet. If you were more of a comic person and liked Much Ado About Nothing and you had a spin on it, you could take it. So plays were actually this very democratic form of education that we've dropped off the map. We've just totally forgotten about it. And now we relegate. There's content for everyone, but it's not made by anyone except for a few people in the higher ups. It's not like indie movies generally get onto Netflix, right? So that's what YouTube was supposed to be for. I guess there's some success there. But again, because there's no golden standard, except in terms of how you produce the content, right? It has to have a certain level of spectacle to it. Otherwise, anything will be watched. Then there's no golden standard like Shakespeare, which pulls you sort of up into the clouds, right? Up into sort of some kind of deep thought, some kind of a deep, meaningful thing. So we're really, we need that too. We need that back.
Mm. Interesting. I don't know, there's a whole lot there to unpack around like how we grapple with that in a world which, you know, is becoming how do you reconcile that with, like, you know, previously there was only, you know, X million people, now there's like 7-8 billion people, like, you know is the answer to that, once again, kind of what we discussed in the beginning, the idea of localism, where these sorts of things, you know, cultures once again reemerge locally? I don't know. It's
I don't have an answer. I mean, somewhere along the line we went from sort of taking a blueprint and making it our own, which is what a play is, which is what a symphony is, right? In other words, a symphony can't just be like, these days we recorded symphonies and then we placed them into YouTube to listen to over and over again. And I think that is a form of decadence, right? There's something actually, I would say, wrong with that, because symphonies were as much about getting people to play them. Like, you would have to actually do the work. You would have to become, like, embody the symphony before you could deservedly hear it. And so people who would listen into it, also new people who played it, like, there was a kind of localized access, you think, or I guess, you know, maybe it was rarer then. And so maybe I'm romanticizing it a little too much. I'm not sure. Mm. But I guess I still see some kind of, I still see some beauty in only being able to hear it if you can make it, only being able to see it if you can perform it. Because that means that you're not going to be in this strange feedback loop of endless consumption. I don't know if that has anything to do with people. I think that has something to do with technology. What we need is a kind of activity of that sort, where it's no longer about what I get out of it, but how I embody something in the giving back of it, So like, in order for me to enjoy a Shakespeare play, I have to memorize the play. I have to get people back together. I have to do the play myself. In order for someone else to enjoy it, they have to perpetuate a culture where somebody like me would be able to perform the play, for example, as if I wanted to do that, and then have an audience. And there's this kind of symbiotic feedback loop between audience and performer. And that hasn't totally left. It's just that a very large audience can get content from a very small group. I don't know how much better a world that is.
It's like we're all voyeurs instead of participants kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've gone much more that way.
Yeah.
So I think being local to some extent rectifies that, but I don't know by how much or in what ways. And I don't know how we, it's a friend of mine said some time ago that he said something like, there is no future. Not to say that it couldn't come, but that he didn't believe that there was anything to.
Okay. Let's
Rachmaninoff. Let's enjoy. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll put that on. I'll splice it into the episode. Everyone can enjoy. And we will be back. We're actually offline. We just quickly spoke about doing a whole series where we're gonna dig into Nietzsche and some deeper philosophy when we're both a little bit more rested. So if anyone's interested in that, if you're listening to this, on Fountain now, you can send a comment, a boost, if there's any particular paragraphs that you'd like Rob and I to explore, anything like that. There's just reach out, tag me on Fountain via a boost comment or whatever the hell it's called, and yeah, we'll dig into this. But Rob, thank you again for coming on, man. I always enjoy our conversations because they kind of push me, and you're one of the, as I said, like, there was a couple words that were coming to mind as you were talking. I was thinking, like, you know, classical revival, and yeah, listening to you talk also reminds me why you sent me Bronze Age Pervert's book. You were the guy who actually sent me that, I remember. And it's like, yeah, dude, you're a wealth of knowledge, and truly a contrarian thinker, particularly for today's day and age. And I hope at the very least, even though this discussion doesn't seem to have had a specific point, I hope people can take elements of it and go down some random tangents, as hopefully it enriches their life in some way.
Yep. If you have any interest in working or helping out with the Bitcoin Today Coalition or with My First Bitcoin, or you would like to make a donation to either, please reach out to me or to anyone else on that team. But if you want to reach out to me, my general email is robert@malkarobert.com. You can also find me on Twitter at rjmalka, M-A-L-K-A. So thanks.
Beautiful. All right, my man. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Wake Up Podcast. Find us on the Fountain app and send us a boost with a comment. I'll try and read them each week and send you a shout out. And remember to grab a copy of the Uncommunist Manifesto and join us in defeating the plague that is consuming our world.